Russian Defense Ministry says its missiles destroyed U.S. and European arms shipments in Ukraine's western Lviv region. Moscow says Ukrainian soldiers at the besieged Azovstal steel plant in the port city of Mariupol have surrendered. Plus, Britain saying it will unilaterally change the terms of post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland. This amid EU warnings that unilateral action will have consequences. This is World News from our Tehran headquarters. Sam Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, the Russian Defense Ministry says its missiles have destroyed U.S. and European arms shipments to Ukraine's western Lviv region. Lviv is located near the Polish border and is the main entry point for military hardware sent by the West. The ministry also confirmed that more than 250 Ukrainian fighters in Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant have laid down their arms and surrendered. They'd been trapped in the plant for more than 2 months. Russia is now in full control of Mariupol. In the north, a Russian airstrike on a village in the Chernihiv region has killed 8 people, wounding a dozen more. The war in Ukraine began in late February. The Russian president says it's impossible for some European countries to completely shun Russian oil imports for now, and that's because the European Union is proposing an embargo. Vladimir Putin says that those states are so heavily reliant on energy imports that they cannot ditch Russian oil for a long time. Putin made a comment in a televised meeting with a group of domestic oil managers and government officials. The Russian president also noted that Western sanctions and a possible embargo on Russian oil have pushed up global prices and have stoked inflation across Europe itself. Now, the comments came as EU members are negotiating oil embargoes on Russia over its war with Ukraine. The latest round of talks between the bloc's foreign ministers failed this week due to a veto from Hungary that's heavily dependent on Russian oil. Finland's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's proposal to apply for membership of the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. 188 lawmakers in the 200-member parliament voted in favor of NATO membership. Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said that his country, along with Sweden, would submit applications to NATO on Wednesday. The announcement marks a dramatic shift in Finland's decades-old military non-alignment policy. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has expressed his opposition to Finland and Sweden's joining the bloc. The two Nordic countries require Turkey's support, as all NATO members must agree to their bid. Russia has repeatedly warned Stockholm and Helsinki against the move. Moscow sees NATO's eastward expansion as a direct threat to its security. The UK has announced plans to alter the terms of the post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland, despite EU warnings against any unilateral action.
I am announcing our intention to introduce legislation in the coming weeks to make changes in the protocol. Our preference remains a negotiated solution with the EU. And in parallel with the legislation being introduced, we remain open to further talks if we can achieve the same outcome through negotiated settlement.
The UK Foreign Secretary says that a bill will be introduced in Parliament in the coming weeks to make changes to the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. But she added that a legislative solution is not about scrapping the protocol, and it will remain in consistence with Britain's obligations under international law. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the EU. It effectively created a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland. The EU says that any unilateral UK action on the protocol represents a clear breach of international law. It's warned that it will respond with all measures at its disposal in case the UK goes ahead with the alterations.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party Sinn Féin came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy in the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
This is the Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it, but to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place. It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
In the UK, the surge in the cost of living is taking a heavy toll on the health of the people. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons say that their health has worsened due to such factors as heating and food costs. One in four cited assessments by medical professionals, adding that stress was a contributing factor to their ill health. According to the Royal College of Physicians, this should sound the alarm, especially as the inflation crisis has barely begun. Retailers have been warning that food price inflation could hit 10% this year, and that's partially driven by the war in Ukraine and the overall consumer price inflation that hit the 7% in March. The Bank of England says that rising food prices are a major concern. The European Commission has sharply revised down its economic growth forecast for both the European Union and the Eurozone in 2022. It's also almost doubled the estimate for inflation compared to its February readings. Now, we've discussed that issue in depth in our news review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Russia's war in Ukraine is taking a heavy toll on Europe's economy. The European Commission has now slashed its expectations for the Eurozone's growth while increasing its inflation forecast for the Monetary Union. The EU's executive arm cut the annual growth for both the bloc and the Eurozone to 2.7, blaming soaring energy prices. The figure is down from the previous forecast of 4%. It also predicted that consumer prices in the euro area will go up by 6.1% year on year. That is a near doubling of the previous forecast of 3.5%. The European Commission also hiked the expected inflation for the EU much higher than its earlier forecast. The Commission warned that the forecast is subject to high uncertainty and risks, noting that it could worsen further if Russia completely cuts off its oil and gas supplies to Europe. For more on that, we are joined by our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who is joining us live from Brussels, and also Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Jerome Hughes. Now, Jerome, of course, we saw in your reports that these sanctions that were imposed by the European Union on Russia is now backfiring on Europeans themselves. And now we see in these economic reports, as I told you, the forecasts that are now being considered. Can you please tell us more about the economic situation that the Eurozone will be facing
Indeed. Well, perhaps it's more practical and more beneficial to focus on what actually is happening as opposed to these forecasts, because I think there's a general consensus that the forecasts are not worth the paper they're written on. I mean, even a month ago, you'll remember Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, which manages the euro currency. She said, you know, when asked about how bad could things go, she said, quote, who knows? So really, there's no way of knowing what could happen. But what we do know for sure is in the past year, year on year, energy prices in the eurozone increased by 38% in April, and they've certainly increased since then. And to put a sort of a real example on that, if you bought 200 litres of home heating oil in April, it would cost €275. If you buy 200 litres of home heating oil today, it's going to cost €300. So it's even in 1 month, it's gone up by €25. And that's right across the board when you're talking about home heating oil, but you're talking about, you know, fuel for cars as well, and the knock-on impact as well, because a lot of the gas generates electricity, so electricity prices have gone up. So really, things are in a very bad, they're in a very bad state as we speak. But these forecasts could be overly optimistic. There's no doubt about that, because as Christine Lagarde says, who knows what happens if Russia decides to cut off all of the gas supply
exactly.
to the EU.
Exactly. All of this is happening, Jerome, while Russia has not cut off its oil and gas supplies just yet. So let's bring in Rodney Shakespeare to see what will European Union be looking at if that happens, Professor.
Well, this is weird. They've gone completely mad. There's more sense in Alice in Wonderland. You've asked me about Russia cutting off the supplies of oil and gas. Who is trying to cut off the supplies of Russian oil and gas? Who is sanctioning Russia in the endeavour to do this? And then talks about what happens if Russia cuts off the supplies of oil and gas. Their logic and their grasp of reality has absolutely collapsed. They're now in a mental state of trying to destroy Russia and to say and do anything. As regards these figures of growth, what growth? When your inflation is officially 6, it's really 12, going up to 15 or 20. In the UK today, they're talking about 10, it'll soon be 15 or 20. Where is the growth? Have any of these people even gone to the local supermarket and done any shopping? They are now saying and doing anything, and their minds are going round in a whirl of hatred. And they've lost control of the situation, and all I can say is this is going to hit the people watching this program and the citizens of Europe. It's going to hit them worse and worse, and there is no solution to it coming from these elitists at this moment.
Let's take a look at some social media reactions to this story. So we have Aritis Grawalis, who says maybe the EU should remove sanctions that they placed on Russia. These sanctions hurt ordinary EU citizens while Russia's economy is flourishing and currency value is skyrocketing, unless the EU wants its citizens broke and hungry. AKR says the whole EU is chasing rubles, thus strengthening it against its own currency, the euro. The EU is strengthening Russian economy, its currency, and paying for the Russian military operation. How ironic. Farshad Mirzayi says the EU needs governments who actually care about the EU, its economy, and its citizens, not weak governments who only blindly follow U.S. orders. It is time for a change in the EU. The EU needs to be independent. And Tin Man says Germany, Europe's largest economy, is bracing for the prospect that Russian natural gas cut off suddenly, a shock that would trigger a form of martial law for energy and affect 80 million people and businesses. Lesson, swim with the sharks, expect to get bitten. Thank you very much. That was Rodney Shakespeare, Professor of Economics from London, and also our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, from Brussels. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us.
Now, welcome back. Let's move on. Official results from Lebanon's parliamentary elections indicating that independent candidates have made unprecedented gains in the Sunday polls. According to the Interior Ministry, independent candidates won at least 13 seats in the 128-member assembly. The campaign against the ruling elite and vowed to bring about reforms. Hezbollah resistance movement and its allies won 62 seats, but they lost their majority. Hezbollah's opponents, including the Saudi-aligned Lebanese forces, that's a Christian faction, has gained ground. The results leave parliament split into several camps, with none of them having an absolute majority. Now, this raises the prospect of political paralysis and tensions that could delay reforms needed to steer the country out of its devastating economic crisis. Now, in Libya, clashes have erupted between supporters of two rival prime ministers vying for power in the capital, Tripoli. There were no major reports of casualties, but some vehicles were set on fire. Tensions were sparked after Fethi Bashagha, who was appointed as prime minister by Eastern-based parliament in February, entered the capital overnight. His supporters clashed with groups backing interim prime minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah. Hours later, Bashagha withdrew from the capital over the security and safety of citizens. Last year, Dbeibah was appointed under a UN-led peace process to lead a transition to elections, but a vote that was set for December indefinitely postponed. The country has been ruled by rival governments based in Tripoli and Tobruk since the civil war broke out, following the ouster of longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi in 2014. A heavy dust storm has forced the closure of schools, universities, and public offices across several Iranian provinces, including the capital, Tehran. The dust storm, originating from Iraq and Syria, entered Iran on Monday, blanketing eight provinces, mostly in the west. The concentration of fine dust particles in some cities is 20 times higher than safety levels. In neighboring Iraq, officials say at least 4,000 people have swarmed hospitals with breathing problems. This is the eighth sandstorm to hit Iraq over the past month. A thick cloud of dust has enveloped the capital, Baghdad, in an orange glow, prompting the city's authorities to declare a day off for local government institutions. Baghdad International Airport has halted all flights. It's closed its airspace until further notice. According to the United Nations, Iraq is the fifth most vulnerable country to climate crisis. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities, and membership in any political party or group due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic Revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulama and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the US, hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the US started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like The Deluge and the story of Joseph and Zuleika in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it? But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too. The noble prophet demolished the Zarar Mosque. That we are opposed to cinema, it means we are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy, and for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists? They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued, every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters. Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation? Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for all His blessings, the greatest of which is the blessing of guidance. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Luqman says, وَلَقَدْ أَتَيْنَا لُقْمَانَ الْحِكْمَةَ أَنِشْكُرْ لِلَّهِ. We gave Luqman hikmah, wisdom, أَنِشْكُرْ لِلَّهِ. I don't want to discuss this right now for different reasons. Do the shukr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Be thankful, rough translation right now, very rough. So it mentions the idea of being thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then saying that مَنْ يَشْكُرْ فَإِنَّمَا يَشْكُرُ لِنَفْسِهِ. Whoever is thankful towards Allah, it's for their own benefit. They're not helping God. They're not adding anything to God. They're not... It's for themselves. The only benefit that there is for shukr is for themselves.
And then it starts to quote. It starts to quote Luqman. The verses do. وَإِذْ قَالَ لُقْمَانُ لِابْنِهِ. Luqman said, remember the time that Luqman said to his son, وَهُوَ يَعِذُهُ, while he was advising him, يَا بُنَيْ لَا تُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ. Oh, my dear son, do not hold associates, partners with God. لَا تُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ. Don't be a believer in shirk and polytheism. إِنَّ الشِّرْكَ لَظُلْمٌ عَظِيمٌ. That's a quote from Luqman, which of course, when God says, we gave Luqman wisdom, and remember when Luqman addressed his son and said these words, that means approval. God is saying, we gave him this wisdom. So these words are approved of. Although, of course, all of what is mentioned there that is telling us what Luqman told his son are things that we actually find in other verses of the Quran as well. But there's a reason why I'm emphasizing this. Then God changes that a little bit, and the language at least is that he's not quoting Luqman. وَوَصَّيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ. It's like in brackets, the story is being told of Luqman addressing his son and talking to him. After their first point, which is not to be a polytheist, not to believe in multiple gods, not to hold any partner with God. Don't partner anyone with God and say that this person is also has some level of lordship by God in any way. No, no form of shirk. That was what Luqman said, and the Quran quotes that. Then in brackets, in a sense, punctuation that we notify the reader that this is not... It's in between a story, but it's not exactly part of that. Why God speaks in that way, it's a whole different story. Why are the verses like that? It's a whole different story. The point is here, this is not quoting Luqman. It's not a verse. All of it's from God. Sometimes God quotes a person, and sometimes God doesn't quote a person. This is not part of the quote. وَوَصَّيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ. We advised the human being بِوَالِدَيْهِ, to his parents, or in regards to his parents. حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ وَهْنًا عَلَى وَهْنٍ وَفِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْنٍ. His mother, the human being's mother, a person's mother, bears him وَهْنًا عَلَى وَهْنٍ, difficulty after difficulty. Again, rough translation. That's what I recall the meaning of وَهْن. That may not be very accurate. What I recall is that the point we're trying to make is not regarding this. Go read the translation. From what I can recollect of my memory of the meaning of the words, is difficulty after difficulty. وَفِصَالُهُ. And so حَمْل, the pregnancy period that the mother carries the child in her womb, and then afterwards فِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْن. Afterwards, the child is dependent on the mother in her nursing him up to 2 years. All that period, all those difficulties. So it doesn't mention the father here. That's for another time. It's interesting. We advise the human being to the parents. And then the one that's mentioned is حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ. The mother is mentioned. We advise towards parents, and then the mother is mentioned, what she went through for every person that is alive, that is born. Anishkur li. What's the advice? Anishkur li. Be thankful towards me. Wali walidayk. And be thankful towards your parents. Now, I don't want to focus about parents, that meaning of parents right now, because there's other things that are there that the whole package needs to be discussed. We've discussed it before, and we have all heard this idea. The only point I will say in regards to that is that, as you see here, it doesn't say be obedient. It says ishkur li wa li walidayk. It puts shukr of Allah first, and then shukr, and being thankful towards the parents. And then that whole thing is connected to tawheed, to Allah. Even what the parents do and what the parents go through, it's connected to him. Ilayya al-masir. What you are becoming is towards Allah. You were becoming towards Allah. You're moving towards Allah. Everyone is. Everything is. إِلَيَّ الْمَصِيرُ. Towards me is what everything becomes. Everything is moving towards him. وَإِلَى اللَّهِ تُرْجَعُ الْأُمُورُ Another verse that says the same, presents the same idea with different wording. It doesn't say obedience. It says be thankful. Being thankful is recognizing their effort in terms of the human being. It's recognizing their effort and appreciating it. That's what shukr means. In the context of the parents appreciating the hardship they went through to raise us, to give birth, the mother is mentioned here first. That is a difficulty, a hardship that fathers just don't even understand. As much as we observe the process, perhaps to a degree, we don't feel it. We don't go through it. It's mothers that go through it. That's something that mothers need to be appreciated for. You need to recognize that, appreciate. She went through all that hardship to give birth to me, for me to be born, for me to exist. Now, I need to be appreciating that. Appreciating that means that if not just for the, that's where it started. And those are things that none of us can give back to our mother. We cannot go through such pain to serve our mothers. What we can do, however, is appreciating that effort. And as we said, it doesn't stop there. That's where it starts. They take care of us up to an older age, at least for the average person through their teen years. They take care of us. Appreciate that. You take care of your parents. This doesn't mean obedience. It's never mentioned that we advise the human being to obey the parents. It's never mentioned. Appreciate. They did that for you. You look for when, at whatever point, something that can help them, assist them, if you can, if you're capable of, with the conditions you have, with the obligations you have, you can, if you can provide that service, especially if they're now in need of you. That's where we have a lot of emphasis. There are times where the parents are now in need of the child and their support and their assistance and their love and their care. And then the child doesn't want to provide that care. The parents put up with all the whining, all the crying, that they didn't even know what the cause is. Now that parent is older in their age and every little thing bothers them in ways, as the Quran says, similar to a child. And I can't put up with the complaining or the special needs that my father or mother, especially the mother, has. That's where the Quran says that's not right. If the two of them get older with you and you are capable of taking care of them and just get upset because they have more needs and you get frustrated with that, no, لا تقل لهما أوف. It's like أوف is when you're frustrated. Like, oh, he wants this. Can you turn this down? It's too hot. It's this. They may complain. They may get edgy. They may shout. When you were a baby, you did all of that. They took care of you. Appreciate that. Don't say oof. It doesn't mean don't say anything that they dislike. Sometimes you got to say something. The Quran says, do amru al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar. We have right here. Amru al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar. Anyone who hears amru al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar, nobody likes to be criticized. Amru al-ma'ruf wa nahi al-munkar is criticism. If you see your parents doing something that's wrong, you have a job. Don't approve of it. They want approval from you. You can't give approval. They're not going to like it. Does that mean just, oh, I can't do that. I have to listen to my, I got to do. No, that's not what it says. It's not what the Quran says. People do that culturally, whatever. That's their thing. The Quran, don't attribute that to Islam. Islam does not say obey. And Islam does not say that taking care of them and not being upset with their demands and what they're asking of you in their old age because of their conditions, to be patient with that and don't express frustration. That doesn't mean that you're not allowed to say anything that they don't like. That's...
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned but also opposed practically, says Khadija Ali, journalist, in an article titled "Islamophobia, the Last Form of Racism in the World." Stay tuned for more. Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned, but also opposed practically. There are numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions affirming concrete action against racial or other forms of discrimination. Yet, Islamophobia continues to rage and exacts a heavy toll of innocent Muslims in many parts of the world, including Canada. One particular UNGA resolution proposed that the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination be observed annually. It coincides with the day the white police force in South Africa opened fire and killed 69 blacks in Sharpeville in 1960. They were holding a peaceful demonstration against apartheid passed laws. South Africa was then under apartheid rule. It ended in 1992 and South Africa elected its first black president, Nelson Mandela, in 1994. In 1979, the General Assembly adopted a program of activities to be undertaken during the second half of the decade for action to combat racism and racial discrimination. The UNGA decided that a week of solidarity with the peoples struggling against racism and racial discrimination, beginning on March 21st, would be organized annually in all states. There is even an international convention on the elimination of racial discrimination, but racism in different forms exist. Its most virulent form is Islamophobia, targeting Muslims because of their faith and how they dress. While states have adopted various measures from perfunctory to serious against racial discrimination, Islamophobia continues to grow with deadly consequences. It exists at multiple levels, individual, institutional, and state. Some individuals may harbor prejudices, but it is the state that provides the framework, both through active policies and also lack of policies to confront this menace that leads to its spread. Let us consider the UNGA debate and subsequent adoption of a resolution against Islamophobia on March 15th. Proposed by Pakistan, the resolution was supported by 55 Muslim-majority countries of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, as well as many other countries in North Africa and Russia and China. It affirmed that March 15th will be marked annually as the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia. March 15th marks the anniversary of the 2019 attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, in which 51 Muslim worshippers were murdered in cold blood as they gathered for Friday prayers. It has now emerged that the Christchurch terrorists, originally from Australia, was influenced in part by a pro-Israel Canadian media outlet, Rebel Media, whose owner Ezra Levant promoted Islamophobic troops. Levant tried to silence, unsuccessfully as it turned out, those that exposed his media outlet's influence on the mass murderer. The Christchurch terrorist was no doubt influenced by other racist outlets and individuals, as well as leading him to commit one of the most despicable crimes against innocent Muslims. The UNGA vote on Islamophobia, while welcomed by OIC Secretary General Hassan Brahim Taha, had its opponents as well. Taha said it would consolidate global awareness of the threat of hatred and fanaticism against Muslims. And who opposed the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia? France, the European Union, and India spoke against the resolution, but did not oppose its adoption by consensus. Looking a little deeper, it is not surprising why these three entities spoke against the resolution. While Europe, especially France, Germany, and Britain have led the racists and bigots and have also enacted laws specifically targeting Muslims, India has also come out swinging against its 200 million Muslim citizens. The French representative at the UN, Nicolas Daud-Rivière, took refuge behind the excuse that France supported the protection of all religions and beliefs, but questioned the singling out of a specific religion. He described the resolution as unsatisfying and problematic. What did he fail to explain was, why has the French regime instituted laws that target Muslims only? Further, Paris took the lead in banning the hijab, the Muslim women's head covering. Women can uncover as much as they want, but Muslim women and girls cannot cover. This goes against French secularism, we are told. And what was the Monsieur Daud-Rivière problem with recognizing Islamophobia as a racist ideology? He said, The term Islamophobia has no agreed upon definition in international law, unlike the freedom of religion or conviction. But it's this liberty that France defends, as well as all other public freedoms, such as freedom of expression or conviction. Though Riviere need not have indulged in such verbal gymnastics, the regime that he represents is racist to the core. They are unabashedly anti-Muslim. The rest of Europe is little better, as was evident from the opposition of EU representative. The bloc represents 27 European countries, and while it has permanent observer status at the UN, it does not have voting rights. The EU representative said a focus on Islamophobia was an unnecessary duplication after the UN in 2019 adopted August 22nd as an international day commemorating the victims of acts of violence based on religion or belief. The EU's Islamophobic attitude surfaced when its statement said, "We are concerned with the approach of addressing only one religion through a General Assembly initiative." The EU representative could not be oblivious of the fact that under the rubric of freedom of expression, vulgar cartoons of the Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, have been published in several European countries. Such acts are meant to humiliate Muslims. Freedom of expression has limits. No other religion or its revered personalities are subjected to such vulgar attacks.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Well, you must be following news related to the nuclear matter. As I have said before, and as other government officials have said before, including Mr. President, who has repeatedly stressed this matter, you must not at all wait for the nuclear negotiations when doing your planning. You must not wait for it in any way. Do your work. Look at the current condition of the country and do your planning accordingly. The negotiations might reach a certain point, positive, half positive, or negative. Whatever happens, you must do your own work and you must not make your affairs contingent upon the negotiations. Fortunately, the Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs and the negotiating team delivered their detailed reports to the President and the Supreme National Security Council. They are being updated on the matters and therefore they will make a decision. They think and consider the various aspects of the matter. Of course, it is all right to criticize these officials and express one's viewpoint. But first of all, you should take care not to express viewpoints in a pessimistic manner. I have always said to officials in all administrations that our attitude towards the people in the middle of the arena should not be pessimistic and cynical attitude. Well, there are pious, revolutionary, diligent, and hardworking people in the arena. And they are working in this regard. If one wishes to make a criticism, it has to be an optimistic, not pessimistic one. Secondly, it must not undermine the people who are busy working in this arena. The people's hope should not be undermined either. In other words, we should not speak in a way that the people lose their hope.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, our negotiating team has thankfully resisted the other side's bullying, and by God's favor, and without any doubt, they will continue to resist. He who has broken his promise is the other side. They themselves have faced serious problems because of having violated their promises. In the present time, the other side, which broke its promises and which tore the deal to pieces, as they themselves put it, is stuck in a dead end. We do not thankfully feel stuck in a dead end. We have managed to endure the hardships and pass through them. We have passed through many problems so far, and we will pass through other problems from now on too, God willing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.